Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent. You're listening to the HR Power Hour, and today we are speaking with Jim Reedy. He is the chair of the Labor and Employment Law Group at Sheehan Finney, Bass & Green, a great HR Power Hour sponsor. Jim, thanks for being back on the show.
My pleasure.
Well, you know, there's a lot of stuff happening out there, and today we're going to be going over a number of great topics. But the first thing I'd like to do is kind of get a feel out there of some of the new laws that are coming out. One that is going to be really timely is here it is at the end of September, and that's the use of social media and electronic mail law that is coming out. Can you talk a little bit about that for here in New Hampshire?
Yeah, that's it, right, David. That is a New Hampshire law, but it's a part of a national trend. We saw a bill in Congress in the last 2 years, and we've seen it in other states as well. But there was a notion out there, and it was it hit the media outlets about 6 to 8 months ago, as to whether or not employers were asking applicants and employees for their passwords, their usernames on social media so they could look at their activities, and to the extent that those things were private, asking applicants and employees to lower their privacy settings. So there were several competing bills in Congress and also in even our state legislature here in New Hampshire, but this bill did pass. It's House Bill 1407, and it will be effective the end of September 2014. And basically what it provides is that employers of all types and sizes in New Hampshire, meaning that if you have at least one employee, you're covered by this law, it would provide that you cannot ask applicants and employees for their username or their password to social media. And it talks about personal social media accounts. And so distinguished from those social media accounts you might be using as a part of your work. Now, what if you're using your Facebook account, by way of example, on your PC at work? Is that something that they can monitor? Yes, they can monitor it. The employer can monitor that activity going forward because it's the employer's computer system. However, they cannot ask you as an applicant or an employee for your username or password or to lower your privacy settings so they can see even more of your activity. Now, if I'm an employer in New Hampshire and I look at that and I watch my employee spending a great deal of time on Facebook or on Twitter or Instagram or the other things, but I still can't see what they're looking at, I can still say, work time is for work, and I see that you're spending a lot of time on these other activities, which clearly are not work-related. The problem with some of the monitoring activities that employers still can do is the National Labor Relations Board at the same time has said, if an employee on his or her own time or even on work time comments on the terms and conditions of employment on social media, they may not be disciplined as a result of that activity. Now, there's still a question as to whether or not if they do that on work time, again, work time is for work, whether or not they can be disciplined, but the National Labor Relations Board is taking a very broad view, saying that that is protected, concerted activity, meaning that if someone is talking about their terms and conditions of employment, and they're not just talking about themselves, but they're making a statement perhaps that would apply more broadly to other of their coworkers, that's protected activity, even in a non-union environment, especially in a non-union environment. So this is a developing area of the law. New Hampshire has taken a step forward with regard to prohibiting the activity. But as you know, David, and we've informally surveyed HR groups in the last couple of years and asked, how many of you ask applicants or employees for their password, their username, or ask them to lower their privacy settings? And I must say, I'm out there a lot and talking to lots of groups, and I know you are. I've never seen anyone admit to it. Now, they could also say, you know, I don't watch television. I don't eat junk food. And then we know that they do.
Yeah.
But our sense is that actually was not a widespread problem. But the law has taken a step forward saying you cannot ask for these things based upon some sense that there is some activity like this going on out there.
You know, with this would this be an area where they need to look at their employee handbook and decide whether or not there needs to be a change in it? Certainly if they're in terms of the hiring practices, I get that and understand that, you know, they may want to add or look at their questions. They may have formal questions they're doing for interviewing. But is there anything in this that has to be modified in an employee handbook?
Only if the short answer is only if you mention your monitoring activities, only if you mention in your social media policy and that, issues with regard to employee use of social media and the like. And after the National Labor Relations Board a year ago, came out with their pronouncements on, and it's not a matter of law, it's just what they view the use of social media and employers' reaction to how an employee might post on social media. A lot of employers, with guidance from lawyers like me, change their social media policies to say, look, nothing here in our policy is meant to interfere with your rights under the National Labor Relations Act. And then the next thing is training your supervisors or those that might monitor is that, guys, let's be clear, we cannot discipline employees based upon these things. And I think the same is true with regard to hiring practices. For years, we've worked with employers to say, these are the questions you can ask, these are the topics you can cover, these are the ones you stay away from. And perhaps this would be certainly added to that new hire checklist.
Great. We're talking with Jim Reedy. He is the employment attorney with Shee and Finney Bassett Green. You know, one of the things that has come up a lot, and I actually heard it myself from one of the EEOC representatives at a HR forum in the Portland market. He was up here talking about the fact of the changes that that they're recommending from the EEOC regarding applications and the check the box movement that, to remove anything having to do with criminal history from an application or asking questions about criminal history. What's your take on this and in terms of the guidelines, in terms of the perception by employees? I got to tell you, in that forum where we had a meeting, there were probably 85 to 100 HR professionals there. It got pretty tense with the EEOC gentleman who was there. And there was a lot of shaking of the heads of disbelief about asking about, criminal history.
Yeah, it's a relatively hot topic. It's been EEOC came out with their guidance about a year or so ago, and now their field representatives are out there promoting that. And the check the box is that you referred to is that it's the shorthand way of saying, have you ever been arrested or convicted of a crime? And then some applicants talk about a crime that has not been annulled by a court. Some talk about felonies and misdemeanors. Some have a durational limit. Some do not on the criminal history and so on. EEOC has for years, and I mean going back to the 70s when you and I were both in grade school.
Kindergarten.
Yeah, there you go. have talked about this for years and said, focus more on convictions than arrests, because surveys show, demographics show, that African Americans, Hispanics, and others, other minority groups, racial minority groups, are arrested more frequently than Caucasians. And statistics did bear that out and still do bear that out. And so therefore, by focusing on arrests, there is a disparate impact upon certain racial groups. Well, employers, for the most part, don't focus on arrests. They may ask about arrests, and some state laws, like New Hampshire, say you can ask about arrests. Ask about arrest or conviction that have not been annulled by a court. EEOC's guidance, therefore, this is an upgrade from the 70s guidance, basically says, look, you should really focus on convictions, but there are instances when you can talk about arrests. But that's sort of being lost in the white noise of their trainings that are going on. And the short answer is employers can still, for certain jobs, ask about arrests. They also say in their guidance, convictions over a certain period of time really shouldn't be considered. And there's sort of a street law out there that people say any conviction over 7 years you really can't consider. That is absolutely not true. If it's 7 years and a month, if it's 10 years, if it's 20 years, a conviction of a certain type, I would want to know. So they have carve-outs for certain types of professions, whether it's daycare workers or teachers or camp counselors and so on. But I wouldn't limit it to those professions. I would look at the nature of the job, the nature of the offense, when the offense occurred, what has happened since then, and whether or not you know, public policy would support a person with that criminal history. And, of course, I always go to, as a parent, I go to my kids, where they're in school or summer camp or where they're working, and the people that they work with, and what is their history and what are their propensities. And so that's what I would look at. So it has caused quite a pushback, and I will tell you there was a recent case in federal court that dealt with EEOC's guidance with regard to criminal history. And EEOC on their own sued an employer because the employer was asking about arrests and didn't have a durational limit on the convictions. And it's a wonderful decision by a federal district court that says, wait a minute, we just looked at the record and EEOC themselves asked about criminal history for 90% of their hires. So how is it that you are now saying employers can't do the same thing? So that a level of hypocrisy there. So I understand the pushback from the audience in the Portland area. We get the same here in New Hampshire and in Massachusetts. And the answer for New Hampshire is a little bit different than it is in Maine, that we can still ask about, have you ever been arrested or convicted of a crime that has not been annulled by a court? Now, what we recommend for employers is, you don't just ask that and have the box checked. Then below that, you have a line that says, please explain. That EEOC case very quickly talked about a process, and the process was this. That company at issue had asked about criminal history, and it was on their application. They later, with the consent of the applicant, if that person was proceeding through the screening process, they would vet that, and they get the authorization from the applicant to check further. Now, so therefore, they would use the application to check the person's truthfulness or veracity as to whether or not they have been completely truthful about their employment history and also their criminal history and other personal matters. And then once the information came back from whatever agency they used to check the information, they would present it to the applicant and say, is this you? Can you explain? And then even then, before something bad happened, meaning ending someone's employment or the like, it would be checked by another person from in HR with another person in the organization before they made the decision. And the court said in that case, that's exactly what we're asking for. That's, in many ways, that's what the Fair Credit Reporting Act, that's what state laws are talking about, and so on. So that's a process in many ways that employers should follow. We're not automatically going to exclude because of criminal history. We'll look at the nature of the job, the nature of the offense, and so on. And we'll also follow the governing law with regard to whether it's state or federal, with regard to verifying the information through a source and also talking to the applicant before we make a decision on his or her employment.
In terms of this issue, background check forms versus forms that say on the application you're going to, you know, check into the background, do you recommend there be a separate form that lists out what exactly the background check is going to cover, or can it be covered in an application, in your opinion?
It all depends. I think if we look at handbooks, if you've got a handbook that's good, that's 700 pages long, no one's going to read that. If you have a handbook instead that's 30 to 50 pages long with an indices in it, and you have a well-trained staff that can say, now on page 15, this is our policy and we consistently follow it, then I think that that's a more workable handbook. Likewise, if you've got an application that's 3 to 5, 7 pages long, and you're talking about an entry-level position, and English may be an issue with regard to the person, or competency may be an issue as far as the retention or being able to get through a form, then that's a wasted effort. If it's a concise form, 1 to 2 pages, it's clear as to what you'll be checking and getting the person's authorization. And it isn't like a software agreement that we all look at on computers and says, do you agree to proceed? And we just click agree without reading the text. I think that that is a workable form. There are recommendations to have a separate one. There's a benefit to having a separate form where you outline things in greater detail. Ultimately is, how clear is it? How well presented was it? Was the presentation or explanation of the form consistent with the what's written on the form and so on? Because that's where you can get into a little bit of trouble too. Like, well, the supervisor didn't say anything. He just said it's a form from corporate. I should just sign it. So having the person take an opportunity to read it, confirm that they've had an opportunity to read it and they understand what they're signing, makes good sense, whether it's on an application or a separate form. If you're going to have a separate form, you ought to make sure that you have a record that you keep it both together in the personnel file if ever questioned later.
No, I think that's solid advice. One of the other things that's coming up and being discussed a lot in terms of groups across the country is this new guidance from the EEOC on pregnancy discrimination. Can you give your take on this and what needs to be changed for employers?
Well, there is new guidance from them, and I think this is a relatively hot topic, not in the history of mankind, because for as long as mankind has been here, they've been men and women, and women have been pregnant. I read my Bible recently.
That's good for you.
But the EEOC's guidance is the Pregnancy Discrimination Act, which goes back to 1978, and many state laws actually predated that, which are protections in place with regard to pregnant women, and the fact that employers cannot discriminate because a woman is pregnant, so during the pregnancy, and offering reinstatement rights afterwards when it's medically permissible for the woman to return to work. And as we know, at the same time, we have an overlay of the Family Medical Leave Act and also certain state laws that provide additional protections with regard to the pregnant employee. Now, the thing to remember is what we're talking about is a woman, and we're talking about a pregnant woman. It doesn't apply. The pregnancy statutes do not apply to adoption and surrogacy. They deal with the pregnant female. But EEOC is talking about, because of the experience at the federal level and also at the state level, pregnancy discrimination claims continue to be among the most common, the most frequently seen on a federal and a state level, regardless of the fact that these protections have been in place. And in the decency of most workplaces, there's a respect for a woman who's pregnant and allowing her time off during the pregnancy and the notes that are required for purposes of fitness to duty and return to work and the guarantees about return to work, a comparable position if her position is not available at the time that she's able to return. EEOC says, based upon that experience, we ought to be looking at a couple of things. And one of them is treating pregnancy now, which is new, as a short-term, potentially a short-term disability. And it's always been treated as a short-term disability, but potentially treated as a disability under the amended ADA, because that was never the case until 2009. They said under certain circumstances, a pregnancy might actually qualify as a disability. Otherwise, pregnancy is treated as a short-term disability. So more and more the EEOC, and especially a part of this new guidance, is saying, let's focus on during the pregnancy, and let's look at what a comparable position is. Let's look at what reinstatement rights are, and how long that reinstatement rights last. And one of the cases pointed to in recent training from EEOC was a woman being reinstated to the job, only to be having the job eliminated a week or two afterwards. And they said that's not an effective reinstatement, and so on.
No, that's great. We're talking with Jim Reedy. He is the employment attorney at Sheehan Finney Bass & Green. You're listening to the HR Power Hour, and we will be right back on News Talk WLOB. If you're responsible for hiring and firing, you know it can be like a roulette wheel. If your new hire turns out to be a bad hire, well, all you've lost is time and money. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Don't gamble with your hiring. We have a better solution. We've helped hundreds of companies like yours find the right talent, and we guarantee it. Career Management Associates delivers people that fit. Go to cmacareer.com.
They say it's never too late to be what you might have been. So if you want to turn your passion into your profession, AARP can help you find new opportunities that take advantage of Work Reimagined, a program that leverages the power of LinkedIn. AARP also provides access to tools, resources, and information that can help you at every step. Just a few of the ways AARP helps turn your goals and dreams into real possibilities.
AARP, real possibilities.
Go to aarp.org/possibilities to find tools and guidance.
Real Possibilities is a trademark of AARP.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com. And today we're talking with the great James Reedy. He is a employment attorney with Sheehan Finney Bass & Green. And I got to tell you, they're a great organization because, of course, they're great sponsors of the HR Power Hour. And, Jim, we appreciate that very, very much.
No, it's my pleasure. Great organization to be associated with.
One of the things that your organization does, which is unique, I think, because I really haven't seen this done many other places, is an email forum called NH LaborNet. Could you first explain it, because I think it would be good to have listeners understand what it's all about for here in New Hampshire. Could you explain what it is, what it does, and then what we're going to do is we're going to talk about some of the most common, popular questions that come up and answers that are out there, because I think it would be very good information for all the rest of the listeners.
Yeah, New Hampshire LaborNet has been around since, 1995 or so, and that was when, if we think back to 1995, not a lot of employers had PCs on their desks yet, or at least integrated PCs through a mainframe. So as we sent it out, it was like sending a message out into deep space. We got a few responses initially, and then it absolutely exploded. We have over 3,000 members on New Hampshire LaborNet, and imagine, you know, the size of New Hampshire, and while it is a vibrant economy with lots of HR professionals, our membership goes well beyond New Hampshire. We have members all over New England and beyond. We have them as far away as Florida and the West Coast. We actually have a few members now in Canada. So New Hampshire LaborNet basically is an interactive discussion group. It's an e-discussion group. It's via email, and it's a listserv. So that means that replies go to the entire list. And the benefit of that is if someone asks about, you know, there was a question about inclement weather and what do you do with regard to inclement weather and a call-in policy and the like. And you get employers of all types and sizes reply, and others will say, do you have a sample policy with regard to drug and alcohol testing or social media or employee smoking? And you get a whole host of responses. Others will ask questions about, I have a situation involving this or that, and we ask that that the people that post things, one, because they have to identify where they're posting from. There are no anonymous postings. They don't say, here I am in on Elm Street in Manchester, New Hampshire, and this morning I had an unusual situation where an employee showed up, and let's just call him Bob, and he's wearing a short-sleeve shirt today and plaid pants, but otherwise I can't tell you who he is. And he showed up for work smelling of alcohol again. Now, his wife, let's just call her name Susan, and talking about way too particular, and we're thinking about firing Bob at 3 o'clock today. Well, the problem is Bob may know lots of people out there, including perhaps an HR person at another company, and you're potentially dealing with situations that may be disclosing to a wide audience confidential information. So we ask that you're not that particular, because these things, because we're dealing with workplace issues, it may result in a case later, and you don't want to have part of your case out there in the general public that you might otherwise. They'll say, well, you solicited advice from a discussion group before you made an employment, and privacy issues and the like. So, but apart from that, it's asking about forums. It's talking about discussions. There was a question last night with regard to a workplace bill that's in Congress, and we respond to that and say this is where it is in study committee and so on. So it's an education tool. It's a tool for seasoned HR professionals to share with people that are just entering the field. It's a gut check for HR professionals. This is what I've heard. This is what I propose to do. I understand the FMLA says this about that. This is what I propose to do. Has anyone else ever dealt with things like this before? And it's a terrific exchange. So membership is free. People can join. You do not have to be from New Hampshire because, as we know, most employment laws are based upon federal law with the overlay or the collateral benefit of having a state law issue that you have to look at as well. So we recommend that people try it out for a while. Like I said, we have over 3,000 members, and people have been members for many, many years. And we also promote events like the HR Power Hour on it and upcoming events. So all you have to do is go to Sheehan Finney's website, which is www.sheehan.com. Go to publications and say sign up for LaborNet. It's NH LaborNet, and it's as easy as that.
No, it really is. It's a great forum. Certainly, I'm definitely on the forum, and there are some amazing questions that come across. Some questions that make me scratch my head, but then that would be for anything, right? When you listen to any forum or look at any forum. But there are questions that come up, and so what we have done here is we've picked some of the ones that are most current in terms of some of the bigger questions that are out there or trend questions, multiple questions on a single topic. So I thought we'd go through them, Jim, if that's okay with you. So here's the first one. The first one has to do with our favorite thing under the planet, the ACA or Obamacare, having to do with forms, employer compliance for 2015, for example, that's coming up. There's some stuff that's happening, rules that have just been issued by the IRS, forms that have just been issued by the IRS. Let's talk about that a little bit. Talk about the ACA, some of the most recent things, and some of the forum discussions.
Well, assuming Senator Cruz is not successful in abolishing the IRS continues to function and turn out what they just turned out recently in July were draft forms with regard to employer compliance. We're talking about large employers, more than 50 full-time employees, compliance with the ACA or the Affordable Care Act starting in 2015. And as you know, and as our audience knows, that some of the deadlines under the Affordable Care Act have been pushed back, and the compliance for large employers is now January of 2016. However, employers have to track that information in 2015. And so what does that mean? Monthly and annual tracking with regard to the number of employees they have, the health insurance provided or offered to employees, the value of that health insurance, and so on. And beyond that, of course, the potential payment of a penalty should you not offer affordable or adequate health insurance as defined under the ACA, and then later will be a withholding of up to 0.9% on wage earners over $200,000 a year and reporting of the value of health insurance on W-2. So there's a lot coming along. So the IRS put out their draft forms for employers to start thinking about, but the important thing to note in that regard is they are just draft forms. Shortly after that was issued, the IRS and the White House issued, and Department of Health and Human Services issued a notice saying they do not anticipate further delays in the implementation of the ACA. But we've seen it many times before where employers have geared up only to be told, hold off, we're going to postpone a little further. But the significance of 2016, of course, we know is that's the next presidential election. So there is a question about timing as to whether or not it will happen during 2016 or afterwards. Right now it is on track. So employers should be taking a look at, the IRS has a website, of course, but within the website there's a new ACA website for the IRS, and that's where the draft forms can be seen, along with their news outlet on the IRS website. You can also look at the Department of Labor website with regard to the ACA, but I recommend for those forms taking a look at the IRS website.
Sticking with the ACA, there have been a lot of discussions on the LaborNet in regards to the state exchange, having to do with enrollment and benefits and different things, private insurance companies and so forth. What's your take on this? What's your, you know, in my understanding, New Hampshire right now, there's only one carrier on the exchange, but they're looking to bring in more. Where do you see this going in terms of the exchange and some of the questions that were asked having to do with how to handle this?
So New Hampshire was one of those states that did not set up its own exchange. Instead, they defaulted to the federal exchange. But with that, you're right, David, that there was just effectively one carrier, but they're talking about at least a couple more coming in. The issue that came up on LaborNet, though, recently was sort of an alarm that, and that's one of the benefits to LaborNet, is that some employers out there dealing with brokers or what they'd heard on the street as they're shopping for open enrollment or a renewal of their insurance policies were some questionable practices with regard to dumping employees on the exchange or getting reimbursements under certain circumstances under the ACA, and people questioning it. And the good news is that basically someone sounded the alarm on LaborNet, and it went out to, you know, again, 3,000 plus members, and on that were more reputable insurance brokers on the list were more reputable insurance brokers, and actually some people that had been talking with the regulators. And there was a notice, and actually based upon that, there's been an enforcement action that's been started with regard to some of these questionable practices, because the brokers and the insurance companies have been identified on these posts. Now, that's something we actually try to avoid on LaborNet, because we want people to speak with some candor. But in this instance, there was a public service done. We know that, of course, the exchange will be open for new enrollments in October, so time is of the essence, and a lot of employers are renewing their group health insurance plans as well. So employers are right now at that period of time where they're looking at, do we continue to offer health insurance, or would you just basically say to employees, you're free to go to the exchange, or offering other alternatives with cost sharing and so on, again, staying within adequate and affordable plans as defined by the ACA. So it's a very interesting period of time, and employers looking at their budget and their bottom line are going through this calculus right now. And what confused the issue was what appeared to be an end run around the ACA. And we know that in connection with that, the IRS does catch up, and so does the Department of Labor. And one of the areas from which they've been catching up on is, David, as you know, because I've heard you talk about this before, was employers that were looking at staying under the float for 50 employees and hiring temporary employees too. Well, the IRS came around and responded to that, saying, well, under certain circumstances, the employer and the temp agency may be deemed to be co-employers for purposes of satisfying the 50 employees and therefore being considered a large employer and therefore having the requirements or obligations assigned to large employers. So we're, like any new law, there are workarounds, there are creative solutions, there are also unanswered questions, and that continues to be an issue with the ACA. But in this instance, this is something that was actually a public service for members of LaborNet and beyond.
I think it's important just to make a note for anybody that's thinking about going on LaborNet, because I think this is an important rule or procedure or policy that you guys have set forth, which makes perfect sense, is that it's not a sales tool. It's not somebody going on there just hawking their wares. It's really about a forum of discussion that HR professionals and others can get involved in asking questions and trying to get useful information. If, in fact, there are organizations that are looking to do business with these organizations, they certainly should and can, but do it outside that forum and may use some of that information to at least contact. So I think that makes perfect sense, but I do think it's important for anybody listening that just thinks, oh, I could go on and put information on, but I think that's one of the important things that you do distinguish on.
Yeah, and I think that as the moderator of LaborNet, I have to be that parent that turns on the light for the teenagers in the rec room and say, wait a minute, let's be clear about the rules here. And so on occasion over the, you know, since we've had LaborNet since April of 1995, I've had to, when someone posts something where they're clearly soliciting or phishing the list, I have to step in and say that's not allowed. Because, we want candor, and we want HR professionals to feel like they're operating in a safe environment. Can they share information about the latest payroll system or experiences and so on? Sure, as long as you're not disparaging the companies or, again, as long as those companies aren't soliciting people. But it's a terrific exchange, and we do have rules that if, as you sign up, you get the rules and you understand. But most people, in fact, nearly everyone complies with them and understands them, and it's interesting because technology, you think, since 1995 has evolved enormously. That's when people still had Walkmans, you know, and so on. But now that LaborNet still continues to be a very vibrant source of information, and actually it's preferable to blogs and other media outlets because of the nature and how it works and because people have PCs on their desks.
Yeah, no, it's real time, and that's what I certainly like about it. You're listening to the HR Power Hour, speaking with Jim Reedy. He is the chair of the Labor and Employment Law Group at Sheehan, Finney, Bass, and Green. You're listening to the HR Power Hour, and we'll be right back on News Talk WLOB.
Thank you. Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at JacksonLewis.com. That's JacksonLewis.com.
Running a company can feel like you're surrounded. A key person quits. A big project presents itself. You need good people fast. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Our contract staffing service will fill a position or find the right talent for a short-term project. Hundreds of companies choose us because we deliver people that fit. Career Management Associates, your contract staffing solution. Go to cmacareer.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by cmacareer.com. Our sponsors for today's show, AARP, taking on issues that matter. Northern Insurance Group, meeting your business, commercial, and personal insurance needs. Sheehan Finney Bass & Green, innovative approaches and practical solutions. And the law firm of Jackson Lewis, all we do is work. And today we're talking with Jim Reedy. He is the employment attorney at Sheehan Finney Bass & Green. Jim, we've been talking about NH LaborNet, the forum that your organization has put together and has been around since 1995, but certainly has now over 3,000 individuals on it across the country, which provides incredible information, real-time information for HR professionals that they can go on and get information back and forth. We were talking about some of the popular things that people are talking about today, and one of the things that has come up, which I am certainly seeing more and more, and I know you are as well, has to do with wage and hour issues, having to do with meal breaks, having to do with timekeeping. Certainly it's come up a lot on the forum about questions about it, and I know that recently in the last month or so has been a number of cases, one that I certainly am familiar with, the LinkedIn one, where about a $6 million fine was paid for improper wage and hour issues. I know you have a couple other examples you'll probably give, but the reality is this is a very hot topic. Attorneys that are on the other side, right, non-employment attorneys, are using this to really go after organizations, class action lawsuits, and make real money for the plaintiff. So how exactly do you see this? What are some of the questions coming up? How would you advise, and what's your take on this?
Well, you know, so we're talking about, generally speaking, class actions under the Fair Labor Standards Act, adopted, I think, in 1938, more recently, so dealing with overtime issues, basically, for what's considered to be non-exempt or overtime-eligible employees. And part of the problem is that some employers view, once I pay you on a salary basis, now you're exempt from overtime, which is not the case. You must be paid on a salary basis in most instances, and you must qualify under the FLSA's overtime exemptions. Part of the problem is that some of the exemptions that were historic have changed. In August of 2004, now 14 years ago, the FLSA changed its tests with regard to the most common white-collar, meaning professional, executive, and administrative employees, exemptions under the FLSA. And they changed the salary basis, which was, it used to be anywhere from $155 to $250 a week, up to $455 a week, and then otherwise changed the definition of exemptions. And one of the easy exemptions you used to be able to get pre-2004 was for administrative employees. Now that's one of the more difficult, given that the changes in the test. So that's been a problem for employers. But you referenced LinkedIn. There have also been, I believe, Petco. There's been Lowe's and large employers where lawyers have been going after the large employers and using, as you referenced, a class action, which is a community of interest among similarly situated employees that have been denied, in this instance, overtime. Overtime threshold being 40 hours in a work week. And if the employees do not satisfy based upon not only their position description, but how they actually perform their job on a day-to-day basis, if they're not If they don't meet the exemption test, then they're entitled to overtime if they work more than 40 hours in a work week. And what is overtime? Overtime is time and a half of their regular rate, 50% more than their hourly rate. Well, what if I'm paid on a salary basis? Well, then it's you break down that salary into an hourly rate, and then for any hours worked over 40, you're paid 50% more. Well, that can get expensive when you're talking about national companies and you're talking about hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands of employees across the country, and you're talking about going back not one but up to, potentially up to 3 years of unpaid overtime. So it can be a real sting for employers, and therefore it's attractive to certain lawyers who want to represent them, and they'll take a cut of the action that they take against the employer. And also what helps in these class actions is if they get the Department of Labor, the U.S. Department of Labor, to bring an action or to assist in this regard, or they piggyback on the action. So it is a hot topic. You'd think it's been around for some time. And it's almost like those infomercials on late night TV where they say, what would you pay for this? Wait, there's still more. Well, the still more that's coming up is the Obama administration, through executive order, recently, this year, did in March of 2014, the president directed the secretary of the U.S. Department of Labor to modernize the FLSA overtime exemptions yet again. Now, pre-2004, they hadn't been updated. The FLSA overtime exemptions had not been updated in 50 years. Now it's just been 10 years, and one of the proposals is to increase the salary requirement from $455 a week to $950 a week, which would actually narrow the number of people that could be exempt from overtime, otherwise said expanding the number of people who are overtime eligible. And there's been some pushback, but there is a directive from the president to the Department of Labor to propose regulatory, in a regulatory fashion, changes to the overtime exemptions, and those are in process. We haven't seen those yet, but those are in process. So that is something for employers to be aware of, because that could certainly change their bottom line and their pay practices.
Now, New Hampshire, the DOL is recently going out and doing some audits, and I know this question came up having to do with LaborNet about timekeeping and meal breaks. What are you seeing on these audits, and what is the New Hampshire DOL doing with this information in terms of either fining or warning individual companies?
The Department of Labor, New Hampshire Department of Labor, like other states, is pretty active in their enforcement efforts, and you're right. They're not only out there doing training, but they're also out there doing audits. And when they do the audits, they have a checklist. And on the checklist is timekeeping. For the overtime eligible or non-exempt employees, are you tracking the beginning of the workday, the end of the workday for every day, meaning the precise time that the employee started work or checked in at work and ended work, and any bona fide meal period in that day? In New Hampshire, we have a requirement, unlike any other states, because other states have it after 6 hours or after 4 hours. In New Hampshire, it's after five consecutive hours of work, you're entitled to a meal break of 30 minutes or so, and it's unpaid unless the employer requires or allows you to eat your lunch at your workstation. In that case, looking at the FLSA, it's paid time if that break is less than 20 minutes in duration, meaning the solitude associated with a meal break and not having to work in any capacity. So Department of Labor looks at timekeeping, they look at meal breaks, and that's on their checklist. And I don't understand why, but certainly with regard to meal breaks, we publish a list every year, the top 10 wage and hour violations from the previous year here in the state. And consistently, since we've been doing that, and it's been, 18 or 20 years we've been doing that list, meal breaks continues to be in the top 10. And that's an easy one. Now, the problem is what happens when, because it's an unpaid break and someone says, well, I've got a 12-hour shift, I'm not taking two meal breaks. Or I've got a 10-hour shift, why would I take a 30-minute break at the end of my 10-hour shift? I took one already, you know, after hour five. Or does it have to be precisely at hour five? Can it be 5.5 hours or 6 hours? And so there is some confusion in that regard. And then there's the, if we didn't keep a record, the employee is saying to the investigator, the employee who's on warning for bad performance or bad attendance, says, oh, gosh, in the 7 years I've been here, I've never had a meal break, and there's no record. Or the other one where employers have an automatic deduction from their timekeeping. Automatically at noontime every day, every employee gets 30 minutes taken off for lunch, whether or not they take it or not. And the Department of Labor says you cannot have an automatic timekeeping system in that regard unless it is subject to change because it's not an accurate record of that employee's meal break for that day. So it's a, you would think it's a relatively straightforward issue, but in practice it can be pretty complicated, and therefore the result is it continues to be a nagging issue for employers in those wage and hour audits, resulting in, as you suggest, potential civil penalties and fines.
Yeah, no, we are seeing this. I mean, employers have been asking questions about this for quite a while, as long as I can remember. And you state some of the obvious. What if the employee doesn't want to take it? What if they want to do this? What if, you know? And there's a whole bunch of questions that come up in terms of forcing or not forcing them to, and making decisions or not making decisions. It isn't as clear-cut as it would sound, but it certainly is definitely an issue that we're seeing at every state level in terms of the DOL. We're talking with Jim Reedy. He is the employment attorney at Sheehan, Finney, Bass, and Green. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB, and we will be right back.
If you're responsible for hiring and firing, you know it can be like a roulette wheel. If your new hire turns out to be a bad hire, well, all you've lost is time and money. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Don't gamble with your hiring. We have a better solution. We've helped hundreds of companies like yours find the right talent, and we guarantee it. Career Management Associates delivers people that fit. Go to cmacareer.com.
You might hear some advice from your friends on choosing a health plan. Darling, you must choose the gold healthcare plan. Not the silver plan. Too much trouble. Do they have a stainless steel plan? I like bronze, like my tan. Are sunburns covered? Instead, take advice from a licensed agent from Northern Insurance Group. Meet face-to-face with a local healthcare exchange professional. Call Northern Insurance Group today. We have the resources to make sure you make the right choice.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com. Today we've been speaking with and continue to speak with Jim Reedy. He is the employment attorney at Sheehan, Finney, Bass, and Green. And I know you're not the only attorney, Jim, but you are the attorney as far as I'm concerned, okay? So we're talking to him about New Hampshire LaborNet, a great forum, email forum, that is produced by their organization or monitored by their organization. We're going to go one more topic here that is a very hot topic on LaborNet, and then we're going to wrap up with some of the things that are on the horizon. So tell me about drug testing policies. This has certainly come up a lot on LaborNet. There have been some recent changes to New Hampshire law. So give us a quick synopsis here of that situation.
Well, drug testing is a hot topic because, as your audience in Maine knows, that there are certain state laws with regard to drug testing and the consequences for violating an employer's drug and alcohol policies and so on. In New Hampshire, the recent changes have been because of the adoption of our state statute with regard to medical marijuana and how that fits into testing and testing positive for marijuana use and so on. More recently, however, there's been a state law that was effective August 25th for healthcare employers with regard to, and it grows out of a case involving a New Hampshire hospital where someone was diverting drugs for his own personal use, and it ended up regrettably in the infecting patients with the hepatitis virus. So there is a new law in New Hampshire for healthcare employers with regard to drug testing, drug diversion, and other issues, and it's one that a lot of employers are now focusing on. The bigger issue is whether or not for applicants and for employees on a national level, employers can drug test. And the short answer is yes. That is an evolving issue, though, because of issues associated potentially with employees with applicants and employees with disabilities, and whether or not there's either a perception about disability discrimination or a privacy invasion. But right now, you certainly can, and you can have policies with regard to drug and alcohol testing, or just simply prohibiting employees from being under the influence of drugs and alcohol, whether or not we're talking about over-the-counter prescription or illegal drugs. You certainly can, but this is an evolving topic, especially with states like Washington and Colorado, where now recreational marijuana is allowed, and I know certain municipalities have their own codes as well. So it's an evolving topic and one that has been lively on LaborNet.
No, it absolutely has been. All right, so Jim, as we wrap up the show today, why don't you kind of give us an overview of things to come, looking into that crystal ball, that future things to come. What do you see?
Well, I think that what we can say very quickly is that workplace law has evolved enormously since 1990. Pre-1990, we didn't have things like the Americans with Disabilities Act, the Family Medical Leave Act, USERRA, the Military Leave Act, and so on. We didn't have the ACA. We didn't have HIPAA, and so on. So there's been a lot for HR professionals to have to know and comply with, and that continues to evolve. Now, Congress has been named again, just like the Truman Congress, as being the do-nothing Congress. That being said, SHRM, the Society for Human Resource Management, has called 2014 the year of regulations. So even though things aren't getting through Congress with regard to workplace laws, there are those that are sitting there in Congress for consideration, and some to talk about are discrimination against the unemployed. I'll go back to that in a second, but in the meantime, federal agencies are adopting regulations at a fever pace, whether we're talking about the Department of Labor, EEOC, Health and Human Services, and the IRS and the like. So those you must always be on the lookout for. In the meantime, Congress is considering some workplace laws, some that have been sitting there for years and some that are relatively new. But one that bears watching is potentially changing Title VII of the Civil Rights Act to include discrimination against the unemployed. Now, some states have adopted that. The District of Columbia has adopted that, which is so adding to the protected classes of gender, age, race, religion, and so on would be unemployment. And that's vexing for employers and say, well, yeah, I didn't hire him or her because their skills were stale and they've been out of this workforce or out of this profession for 5-10 years, and I hired someone who's got more recent experience. So that's vexing for employers. And then some states like New Hampshire have been looking at a new requirement with regard to temporary workers, and that is for those temp agencies that hire people and provide workers, rather, to employers. And the disclosure requirements, which are pretty ominous, requiring them to provide information about wages, benefits, hours, safety, and so on, posters and the like, and it's pretty significant. That went to Interim Study Committee in New Hampshire, but that one has legs and it will likely be back. And there have been a few others like that. We've seen some national trends. I guess the point is, even though we are still climbing out of the recession of 2009, state legislatures especially and federal agencies have been very busy in adopting new workplace laws. In California alone, in the last 18 months, there are 25 new state workplace laws, and that's on top of what the already existing pretty significant burdens on employers. So I guess the point in that regard is our legislatures are busy, the enforcement agencies are busy, and therefore HR professionals have to be even busier and focused on compliance issues.
No, I think this has been a great topic and discussion about what's going on out there, what's really happening. Jim, I want to thank you very much for being on the show today. You've provided great insight, and I want to thank you again very, very much.
My pleasure as always. Thanks so much.
And now the HR Tip of the Week, sponsored by Northern Insurance Group. Licensed agents in 28 states, business, commercial, and personal. Go to northerninsurancegroup.com. Are you seeking a job? Are you out there looking for a better opportunity? One of the things I want to remind you about is that now email has become very, very difficult for people not to simply ignore. There's so much email coming in that ignoring it is just something that happens, unfortunately, day in and day out. So think about a different way of connecting with that individual. Write a thank you letter. Write an actual letter to them. Send them your resume. Yes, it may sound old-fashioned, but it is a new way to come across as the stronger candidate for your job search. And that's your HR Tip of the Week, sponsored by Northern Insurance Group at northerninsurancegroup.com.
Thank you for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 1310 a.m. or streaming live on WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at HRPowerHour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.